Totally Football Show. Today, Anfield. Mo gets Liverpool salivating, but typical Saturday evening viewing as Willian comes on and spoils things. Elsewhere, it was draws and narrow scores galore, except for Newcastle and Everton. Saints fans don't hesitate to call Charlie Austin the top gun, while Everton's problems now running even deeper than Ice Cube's jammy. We'll take the wrap after it was another bad day. We'll look back and forward to a midweek round of action on the way. Then we'll bring you other things like a game of Chester, a Germany, why four means fear if you're Borussia Dortmund, Palace Brighton, and you can listen to the actual moment we sell our soul in this Totally Football Show. In the studio today, Daniel's story. Daniel, how's your book going?
Yep, very well. Down to the last 500, so hopefully all sold out before Christmas.
All right, it sounds a bit like our live show on Wednesday. I'm kidding. There's literally only one or two tickets left. But a Portrait of an Icon, and Alan Shearer was waving a copy aloft. He's got hold of his.
Yes, he's got hold of his. Next on the list is Gary Lineker, who is proving elusive. But oh, yeah, I think four or five of the icons have got it in their hands now.
Right.
Which is a good start.
Okay, and Alan Shearer of particular relevance because he's the patron of the charity that it's raising money for.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. The Bobby Robertson Foundation. Right. He is one of four or five patrons, I think. But yeah, certainly the most high profile.
Excellent. All right. Hey, Michael Cox. You're ready for action in your leather jacket.
Yeah, always. Yeah.
Super. What did you get up to this weekend?
Just watching lots of football, I'm right. afraid, James.
What was your favourite game?
I very much enjoyed Liverpool-Chelsea.
Did you?
I thought it was excellent. Yeah. Saturday night entertainment.
Yeah, certainly was. Ian McIntosh, you went all the way to Huddersfield.
Certainly did.
Where you learnt how to keep yourself warm with a laptop.
Yeah. You know, if you people who play Football Manager will know this, if you set up too many leagues, the computer rapidly overheats and you get very, very hot power pack. But if you're in Huddersfield and you've dramatically underclubbed for the weather, you can get that power pack and stick it down your shirt.
Did you actually do that?
Yeah, yeah. I ran eight leagues and set it to holiday, sort of autopilot thing. Mm-hmm. And off it went, chuntering away in the background, and I stayed nice and toasty.
But how did you do your match report then?
Well, it was just that was in a different window. I wasn't actually playing it. It was just running in the background.
No, I know. But if you stuff it down your shirt, Ian, how are you going to write your match report?
Not the whole laptop, just the power pack.
Oh, I see. Yeah. The power pack.
No.
Right. Well, that's a great idea, though, isn't it? Practical.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to write a little book of tips.
All right, then. I had snow where I went.
Did you?
Yeah. When I woke up Saturday morning, there was snow on the ground. And
on the Welsh border.
On the Welsh border. Yeah.
But I'm not sure the new ground is.
No, it's very much the groundsman quite proudly observed that you can take a corner in one country and score a goal in the other.
Fantastic.
Chester couldn't, but yeah. Probably their visitors could, unfortunately. They're not having the best of runs at the moment. A very exciting game that we had a 4-0 win for Dagenham and Redbridge. John Still, are you familiar with John Still?
I am, yeah.
What
venerable John Still.
Is he the longest serving, and not at one club, but the longestly active manager in the world? He began in 1976.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, with Leytonstone. And still going now with Dagenham and Redbridge, still doing
nice
the business.
Work.
Yeah. Huh. Anyway, let's talk about the Premier League, Michael. Liverpool-Chelsea, you'll be excited to know that Daniel learnt 16 things.
It's always 16.
It's handy.
Although I felt, I mean, you had some important ones in there, didn't you? I thought you were struggling a little bit to make 16.
It was a weird game in that respect, in that quite a lot happened, but kind of felt quite ad hoc. Mm. It didn't feel like it was always to strategy. Chelsea's was give it to Eden Hazard quite a lot of the time, and Liverpool's was give it to Mohamed Salah quite a lot of the time. These games are quite often very, very tight midfield battles, and the two teams that were picked, I expected exactly the same, and yet that didn't actually happen. It was very open. It was very...
Yeah, considering, especially Chelsea's formation, what was it, eight defensive-minded players,
yeah,
you were saying?
Yeah, exactly right.
As Klopp was keen to point out before the game.
So Salah and Hazard were the standout performers, at least until Willian came on, Michael.
Yeah, I thought Hazard first half absolutely ran the show, and I was very disappointed with the refereeing of Michael Oliver, because Liverpool seemed to have free rein to continually foul Hazard without Oliver reaching for his cards, including one incident where Clavin almost literally just grabbed him around the midriff, almost rugby tackled him on the touchline. I can't really understand how that cannot be a booking. It's just such an obvious deliberate foul to give Liverpool an advantage. And indeed, 3 minutes after half-time, Hazard was clobbered by Salah, in fact, when, you know, kind of trying to launch a counter-attack, and then was limping around for the rest of the game, really, and had nothing like the influence he had on the first half. So I thought, really, that was the key moment of the game, you know, aside from the two goals, the fact that Chelsea's best player couldn't run properly.
Okay. You also wanted to flag up, or you certainly did in your piece, Daniel Azpilicueta, with some remarkable numbers there.
Yeah, so he played the final game of 2014-15, their title-winning campaign, having had a couple of games rest before that. And since then, he's basically missed 219 league minutes in two and a bit seasons. And it's not just the consistency of his selection, it's the consistency of his performances at left-back, in a back three, occasionally at centre-back in a back four, as a right-back. And I almost think that versatility counts against him. It certainly counts against him in terms of Spain caps. I think he's only started seven competitive games for Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he has probably been the division's most consistent defender over that period of time.
Who is keeping him out of the Spain team?
Well, I suppose Ramos and Piqué.
I was just wondering, it's not Moreno, is it?
No, although Moreno was called up. But but obviously, I mean, it's quite a long time since Azpilicueta has played left back, isn't it? So, as I said, I suspect it's that versatility that counts. It would make him a perfect, you know, squad player for a World Cup squad. Very versatile, but I think it probably counts against him in terms of actual starts for Spain.
All right.
He must be knocking on the door, Azpilicueta, of kind of all-time Premier League greatest 11, or certainly on the subs bench. You know, there's not many players who've been that consistent in such a variety of positions. I mean, if you're doing a kind of all-time Premier League 11 and you want a defender who can play anywhere, I think he's your man.
We were in the days of two subs. Yeah. Market value.
Yeah.
Did William mean it, Ian?
No.
There's no chance he might have?
No, I think
for me, if a player says he means it, I think it's churlish of everyone to say, no, he didn't. He might have meant it.
The look on his face when that went in, unbounded delight. But it's weird. There's a strange statistical anomaly with Liverpool. No team in the Premier League has conceded more than Liverpool on the road.
Hmm.
And only one team now has conceded fewer at home. Liverpool have only shipped two goals at Anfield, and that was one of them.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, it means they're much better at home than away, which I know is unprecedented. But
and also, Willian was one of the substitutes that Conte brought on, another one being Pedro. And he's proved very good so far this season, Conte, at changing things from the bench, especially down that right-hand side. There's a game I was at against Watford, where Chelsea really were outplayed for the first hour and really could have lost the game. Richarlison missed a couple of really easy chances. And Conte again looked to his bench. I think he brought on Zappa, Costa and Pedro that day. And Chelsea were outstanding for the last 20 minutes. So, you know, Conte's done quite a good job in terms of... you know, he hasn't got the greatest squad, I don't think, in terms of depth, which he's, you know, banged on about previously in the past. But those one or two players, again, you know, you look at someone like Pedro, can play three or four different roles. He's done really well to change games this season.
Mm. All right. Klopp says the world is a strange and crazy place at the moment, so I can easily live with a point against Chelsea. Was it a fair point? Was it a fair result?
I think he would have been extremely disappointed to draw the game, having taken the lead, clearly. But I think it probably was. As Michael said, Eden Hazard was the dominant player of the first half. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And Chelsea could easily have scored in that first half. And at that point, we know from Liverpool that when they play big clubs and concede first, there is a chance that they can kind of capitulate and wilt under that pressure. So I think if Chelsea had scored the first goal, I suspect they would have held out and held Liverpool at bay. So, but it's not a bad result for Liverpool, especially with Tottenham dropping points as well. I think we can all agree that they're not a title challenger. Therefore, they look at the clubs around them and look to keep pace, and they are there or thereabouts, having endured some pretty rotten performances this season.
Some strange and confusing things on the in the technical area towards the end. There was a big row apparently between Liverpool's assistant manager and Liverpool's goalkeeping coach over the time it took to get the substitute on, which they didn't manage to do before the goal. And then Jürgen...
The fourth official wouldn't allow them to... He accused them of time-wasting or something.
Well, the way I'd read it was the fourth official seemed to be indicating that he was like, are you getting this guy on? Come on. And then they didn't get him on for one reason or another. So there was internal dispute there. But then there was also Jurgen Klopp and his tactical debriefing of Sadio Mane on the pitch, which seemed to involve pretty much putting him in a headlock and walking around in circles while shouting at him.
But that's very Klopp, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's all excellent. But there's so much more to tell you about this weekend, including whether Man United might come a cropper this midweek. We'll get on to all of that after this.
The Totally Football Show. We've always been free. And when you think about some of the best transfers of recent seasons, they've been free too. Zlatan to Man United, Pirlo from Milan to Juve, Joe Cole to Liverpool. Yeah. Well, we've teamed up with Paddy Power, and right now you can join Paddy's Rewards Club. Just place 5 bets of £10 or more in a single week and you'll get a free £10 bet the next week. All you have to do is head to paddypower.com to find out more. T's and C's apply. Maximum £10 bonus per person per week. Specific odds required. Excludes shops and cashed out bets. 18 plus only. Be gambleaware.org. And when the fun stops, stop.
Midweek round of games in McIntosh, which will see Chelsea host Swansea, Liverpool go to Stoke. Man City, league-leading Man City, will take on the suddenly rather pepped-up Southampton, who had a big win at the weekend. We'll hear more about that match later on. You saw Man City. You went all the way to Huddersfield to the John Smith Stadium this weekend.
Yeah.
Where we gathered it was cold, yeah?
Yes. It was,
the atmosphere was hot, wasn't it?
Red hot.
Red hot.
Yeah, they like their clappers up there, which is not necessarily a bad thing. The same thing at Leicester, and, you know, the kids like it, and it makes a lot of noise. And I can think of worse things in football than plastic clappers, to be honest. And, yeah, there's a really good atmosphere. And it was interesting, actually, we were talking about this time last week, the two Huddersfields. There's one Huddersfield that likes to clatter into people just beyond the halfway line and really take the game to people. And then there's the other Huddersfield that we saw at Anfield, which drops really, really deep. And it was that one. Pep Guardiola was saying afterwards that he didn't know which Huddersfield he was going to get. He had to tell the team to prepare for these two different Huddersfields and then they'd see which one they got. And
Right. It
was very obvious from the beginning that they got the deeper Huddersfield.
Right. You're always on a knife edge, aren't you, between kind of holding out and disaster there, like giving away penalties. But they managed for so long. They even took the lead.
Yeah, they were brilliant. Schindler, in particular, one saving tackle when Aguero was about to pull the trigger. They actually fist-pumped and celebrated like a goal, which he was entirely right to do. It was one of the best tackles of the season. And, yeah, then they took the lead. They were getting a little bit of joy down the right with Tommy Smith and Thomas Ince, who were linking up really nicely. And there seemed to be a bit of a weak spot around Fabian Delph.
Yeah.
That they seem to be getting a lot of joy out and swinging crosses in. And then, just before half-time, tossed a corner in. Schindler got a head onto it and it sort of ricocheted off Otamendi's chest into the back of the net. Then it was just a question of how long they could keep that lead. And I think it was about 48 seconds.
Yeah. Well, they had a half-time.
Well, yes, 15 minutes plus.
And then the City almost immediately, the penalty in Aguero puts that away.
Yeah.
And then Raheem Sterling towards the end.
I thought what was really interesting is City will generally be very attacking anyway. They'll usually have, even their deepest defender will be up at the halfway line. But as time began to run out, they were pushing more and more until with 12 minutes left, Pep Guardiola took off Vincent Kompany, put on Gabriel Jesus, and essentially played with a one-man defence, because his fullbacks aren't really defenders at the best of times. They're working as kind of basically two left-wingers, two right-wingers. And yeah, it was the most aggressive I've ever seen a football team go. But the key for me, you still get people who wonder about that decision to dump Joe Hart. But Ederson, as a sweeper-keeper, you could really see it when you're there, because there's 75 yards of open space. And all Huddersfield had to do was just hit a long one over the top and then burst into all that space. But of course, Ederson's there, really quick, really brave, running out for headers and clearances. So I guess, in a way, he was the other centre-back.
All right. You mentioned Fabian Delph. Cormac O'Connor saying, what is the record Premier League winning margin and will City beat it? If you're looking at potential things that might go wrong, I mean, it has been touched on before, but again, this game highlighted the fact that, you know, Fabian Delph, you are everybody else's only hope.
I think I'm right in saying the winning margin is 18 points.
Is
which
it?
Which was Manchester United, 99-2000. Mm-hmm. February, really, it was dead. They could challenge that. I think the other teams are relatively strong, though. That was a year where United didn't have a challenge. I think some of these teams will push on and get probably around the 80-point mark. So will City get 98 points? Probably not.
No, there are weaknesses there. They can't really afford to lose any more defenders. With John Stones out and with Mendy out. They're already a weaker side without Mendy. Obviously, attacking midfielders, you could vaporise three of them and they'd still be a fantastic football team. It would be cruel and inhumane, but it's just to prove a point. They're full of goals. I don't think it's over yet, but they're certainly stretching out a bit.
Right.
One thing to say, Raheem Sterling now scoring a goal in every 95 minutes in the Premier League this season. So that's better than Kane, Lukaku, pick your player effectively apart from Sergio Aguero, and that's better than them.
And he's scoring important goals. He's scored, I think, 4 or 5 winners already this season, which for a player who we were told, certainly in an England shirt, was lacking on confidence. He's either turned it around himself or Pep Guardiola has turned him around. I'm sure it's a bit of both.
He's scoring goals after big misses as well. He's been a lot like Mo Salah in that, you know, he's dropped a couple of clunkers and he's still come back to score. I mean, he had one against Huddersfield where he blasted into the side netting when he should have scored. So, yeah, it speaks well of his character.
It's all Pep's. It's all Pep's doing because he told him to stand side on when receiving a pass. A manager actually coaching his players has done.
I think his mum actually. His Sterling said that his mum had told him that he had to get into the penalty area more. And he's since touched the ball in the area more than any other Premier League
player. So she's earned that golden bathroom then.
Indeed. Indeed.
This, of course, was something Sterling had privately complained about when he first moved to City. He went from having Brendan Rodgers coaching him quite heavily to having nothing at all.
Right.
It was a very laissez-faire training. So, yeah, I think that's worked out quite nicely for him now.
Here's a stat for you. Man City were behind at half-time in the Premier League and came back and won. It's the first time they've done that in 22 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a longer time than I thought you were going to say, James.
I'm glad.
Have been behind. They've gone behind 4 times this season in all competitions and won 3 and drawn 1. So it's very much... This new resilience is very much their thing. But yeah, that has surprised me.
Okay, let's hope it's true, eh? Spurs, they looked a bit shot, didn't they? There was a little bit of a kind of post-Europe lassitude, I thought, to a lot of the top teams, narrow wins or... certainly Spurs, Kane looks worn out, doesn't he?
Yeah, you wonder about that injury he had a couple of weeks ago where he missed England duty. He's probably not 100%, but... even not being 100%, he scored the equaliser.
Still got the goal, didn't he? Yeah. So that's their 7th draw in their last 10 meetings with West Brom, and it's only 1 win in 4 now in the league for Spurs. West Brom, fine point for them, and a terrific opening goal for Salomon Rondon.
Yeah, maybe the first time we've seen Davinson Sanchez maybe not, I wouldn't say make a mistake, but he wasn't quite strong enough, I guess, to shrug off Rondon. Should say he's had an incredible start to his Tottenham career, just slotted in a difficult position very comfortably. But it was almost like he underestimated how strong Rondon was.
But it was also because of the fact that Rondon entirely miskicked it, wasn't it? I mean, you have that expression, if anything, he's hit that too well. And this was almost the perfect illustration of why hitting balls well is a problem, because you completely throw not only Sanchez, but also Lloris, who was bewildered by this scuffed shot, which then trickled in at the... Anyway, great for Gary Megson. In what will apparently be the first of 2 games in charge. Am I right in saying he's still going to be there Tuesday night for the visit of, I think it's a visit of Newcastle before Alan Pardew is supposedly going to take over?
What a shame Pardew's not in charge for the Newcastle game.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be exciting, wouldn't it?
It would. Arsenal, we asked if they were going to, but they didn't. But what else happened? Well, Burnley... nice little summary you've done here, Ian. When Burnley met Arsenal in October 2016, Arsenal won courtesy of a controversial last-minute Koscielny goal. When Burnley met Arsenal in January 17, Arsenal won courtesy of an injury-time Alexis Sanchez penalty. What happened this time?
It's another injury-time Alexis Sanchez penalty.
It's miserable, isn't it? Was it a penalty, do you think, Daniel?
I think it was a penalty, and I think Sean Dyche thinks it was a penalty. But after the game, he said it was never not going to be given. Those sort of penalties against teams like us are never not given. I'm not saying it wasn't a penalty, but it was always going to be given, which was basically him saying it's really annoying when referee give fouls against us when we foul in the box. It was a penalty. Burnley were unlucky, but yeah, it was.
Okay.
Everyone focused on the push, but there was a bit of contact with the leg as well. I think
was
it was half a trip and half a push.
All right. Fans of statistics will be excited to know that Arsenal have won all 6 league games in which Sanchez and Lacazette have started together. Mm. Huh. Well... as I mentioned, big round of midweek fixtures coming up, and I'm curious to know what you think about Watford's chances of doing it at home to Manchester United. United, who looked anything but convincing at home to Brighton on the weekend. Watford, who had a terrific result away at Newcastle. What about that Brighton game at Old Trafford? Close to their first ever clean sheet there, the Seagulls.
Manchester United got lucky here, I think. It was one of those games where you do question whether... Mourinho has the kind of coaching ability to make his team break down deep opponents. He must have known what Brighton were going to, you know, throw against them. And in the end, it was just a really lucky goal from Ashley Young.
What should he have done, Ian?
Well, far be it for me to tell Mourinho
what
he should
have done. Well, you've done loads of football managing.
Yeah, but Mourinho himself told Mourinho what he should have done after the game when he said, and I don't think his heart's really in the PR game at the moment. He said, that you will probably want to write that I played too many attacking players. Mm. Yeah, you'll probably want to write that. And you'd probably be right if you do write that I used too many attacking players. It's like,
but you're not about to say that. He's in your head, Ian.
Well, yeah, God, yeah, maybe it's a double bluff. But he's clearly just desperately trying to get people to go, Cavalier Mourinho screws up again. Will he hire a defensive coach?
Or is he also trying to justify a really gritty, dour performance when they go to Vicarage Road? In a clash that surely, Daniel, we should be billing old Moo versus new Moo.
Yeah, there is something in that comparison. Marco Silva, from what Watford players have said this season, is an absolute obsessive in the lead up to every league game. He creates these dossiers that Mourinho kind of became famous for when he arrived in England, and Chelsea's players, you know, had the same surprise at just how detailed their match preparation was. And you saw in Will Hughes's opening goal against Newcastle just how emphatically every player in the system knows what they're doing in every scenario. You know, you've got Richarlison who drags defenders out of the way. You've got the crossfield pass that comes into Richarlison. You've got Will Hughes slightly hanging back as the centre-backs drift closer to their own goal to leave space for the pullback, and then the finish. And they are an incredibly well-organised team. And it kind of sends up a lot of Premier League teams that he can come into a club and within 4 months have a team who were kind of the Hertfordshire Globetrotters last season. You know, you never knew what team selection you were going to get. You never knew how Watford were going to play. And I think only Manchester City and Chelsea have won more away games this season than Watford.
Yeah, it didn't help them too much when City came to visit. They lost 6-0.
But I think that'll happen. You know, Tottenham went to Huddersfield and won 4-0. Manchester City went to Watford and won 6-0. On occasions, these elite teams will click and will make teams look very silly. But Watford are 5 points off third after, you know, over a third of the season played. This is no fluke at the moment.
It's also testament to their recruitment policy. And while I'm still not sure how I feel about the idea of owning three clubs at one point and how right that is, that global scouting network has brought in people like Richarlison, Decore. Whereas, for point of example, West Ham's recruitment policy, as we were discussing last week, seems to be set in 2012. Watford are looking at everything, every advantage they can gain from the way that modern football is, and it's working, and obviously an awful lot of credit to the manager as well.
Decore is an interesting one because he said even a couple of months ago, he said that he was close to joining Lorient in the summer, but Silva spoke to him and persuaded him to stay and told him to be part of his plans and said he had a new role for him. And the way he's speaking, he almost can't believe himself how well he's playing.
Yeah.
Which is a sign of a good manager, if you can make players greater and a team greater than some of the parts and players greater than they ever thought they could be, then, you know, it's easy to see why he's being linked with big jobs.
Although Watford do need a new coach because the supporters' vehicle broke down. And this is a lovely little gesture. Ahead of the game against Newcastle, and the club paid for taxis to get, what was it, about 50 fans?
Yeah, more? Yeah, to get them up from Donington service stations.
Oh, that's great. Well done, Watford.
Just going back to Mourinho, did you hear his really warm words for the supporters after the game? He said, it was quite a surprise, but the supporters were fantastic.
There, yeah.
Oh, a word too, just on the Chelsea fans. Mm. While Watford got stuck in Donington and the club got taxis to get them to the game, poor old Chelsea fans, they had a chartered train that they weren't able to get out to Liverpool South Parkway station in time for. So the train left without them.
But they chartered the train. What was the train leaving without them?
Well, it had to, apparently, because it had a scheduled route in amongst all the regular routes, so it couldn't hang on. The problem was they underestimated how long it takes to get from Anfield all the way out to Liverpool South Parkway. And having been stuck there for just over an hour quite recently, I've a genuine sympathy for the Chelsea fans, because that is not a nice station to get stuck at. Get stuck at Lime Street, you can have a party.
All right.
But not out there.
The Hornets won their clash with Man United 3-1 last season at Vicarage Road. What are the odds of that happening again, Daniel?
It's really interesting, actually, because Manchester United now go into a run of three games where they lost five league games last season, and they lost each of their next three games. They lost each of those last season.
The equivalent fixtures last
year. Watford away, Arsenal away, and Manchester City at home.
Hmm.
So, for all their grinding out wins against teams like Brighton, this is a significant test. And it's not outside the realms that Manchester City could be 12, 13, 14 points clear come the end of that derby.
Troy Deeney, speaking of kind of disciplinary issues, he will be back from his suspension for this game on, is it Tuesday night? What do you think, Michael?
I don't know. Watford's, the last two big games they've played, they were excellent against Chelsea and then lost. And I thought they were really poor against Arsenal and won.
Mm.
So I haven't quite worked out what Watford are all about, to be honest.
Ian?
I'd say that they've got Man United in midweek and then they've got Tottenham at the weekend. I can see them definitely winning one of them. I think they're more than good enough. They're organised enough. They've got fresh legs as well. They're playing two teams who've been playing Champions League football. I can definitely see them getting one win.
Interesting. Well, that's coming up, as I say, on Tuesday night. Before we move on, we should, though, touch on Newcastle's performance in that defeat to Watford, because it was quite extraordinary. Watching that, did you think there's something very wrong in this team?
There's certainly something wrong in that club.
Right.
It's a club that's clearly waiting for its takeover. The striking options are simply not good enough and makes them far too easy to defend against.
Right.
Joselu is a trier, but he's not an achiever. And they're missing Jamal Lascelles at centre-half, their captain.
But in terms of the way the rest of the players who were there approached it, and particularly at the back, and also I would ask, I mean, you were making the point that Silva was pretty much targeting Yedlin on the right wing. And there were some embarrassing scenes, frankly, as he was left behind again and again by Richarlison. Why did the manager, why did Rafa Benitez not do anything about that?
He doesn't have an awful lot of options in that position. He's got a couple of defenders out. He likes DeAndre Yedlin for his ability to overlap the winger, and Matt Ritchie will tuck inside, and Matt Ritchie enjoys dribbling inside and leaving space for Yedlin to overlap. So he... At home, I guess he thought he would rather have that attacking option. But yeah, it was almost like a cup tie where a lower league team has got a player who is clearly worse than everyone else in his 11. And Marco Silva is too good a coach to not spot that. And you're right, Yedlin was embarrassed.
Right.
He'll be annoyed with the first goal, I think, Benitez, because, you know, the fundamental thing in his coaching philosophy is the team remaining compact. And there's a massive gap between the defence and the midfield. That's exactly the kind of goal he doesn't want to concede.
Didn't that get worse, though, as the game went on? The players not getting back? Not even looking bothered about getting
back? Yeah, to a certain extent. But, I mean, in that situation, they did have players back, but they just were, you know, there was a massive gap between the lines, which I think will infuriate him in particular.
I think maybe it was the third one where there was a kind of conspicuous not botheredness about...
Central midfield is an issue. They've got Isaac Hayden coming back from suspension, who I'm sure will play against West Brom.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean... Jonjo Shelvey is a good passer of the ball, but can go missing in games. Isaac Hayden is, to all intents and purposes, a championship footballer.
I think a lot of them are, aren't they? I just don't think it's a great team. I think Benitez has done a good job with really limited options. Even someone like Matt Ritchie has been consistently good in the championship, and I've never been impressed with him in the Premier League. I mean, how many players in that first 11 do you think are Premier League quality?
Two or three, I think.
I'm really struggling to find many.
All right, well, that's why I guess they've lost four games in a row now. They're drifting down towards the sticky end of things, where, if they're very unlucky, they might meet Everton soon, because they're even further down there. We'll talk about what's going on with the Toffees after this. Now, before we get into all that Everton unpleasantness, let's catch up with our continental cousins. France, Paris Saint-Germain, 9 points clear now, just a 2-1 win for them against their rivals Monaco on Sunday night. Monaco actually slipping back to third as Everton's friends Lyon move into second place on goal difference, because they won 5-0 at Nice. 5-0, Daniel Storey. 5-0. Nice now very much in the bottom of three. Heading for Ligue 2. Crikey. Along with Metz. Oh, Ranieri's Nantes lost again. 2-1 at Rennes. That's enough French talk, though, because... Ta-da! Here's Raphael Honigstein. What a stroke of luck you're here, because there's plenty to talk about in Germany. Not least, the Revier Derby. Wow, this was eventful.
It was, James. A derby for the ages, I'd say.
So
Dortmund
this is
4-0 up
right
after 25 minutes. So, and then what happened?
It's Borussia, just for anyone who doesn't know, Revier Derby is Borussia Dortmund against Schalke.
Yes.
So Dortmund, who've been on a rotten run, hadn't won in what, 9 games or something?
One win in nine.
And they go 4-0 up. Brilliant.
Yeah.
It's so brilliant, in fact, that they tweet a picture at half-time of one of their players drinking a cup of tea.
Roman Toprak.
Oh, it's Toprak.
Drinking a tea. And I think that is a bit of a reference to the Mesut Özil tea drinking
is it?
Gif.
Right.
Yes. But unlike the Arsenal one, it backfired because Schalke came back somehow, turned it on. Dortmund's frailty came back to the surface, and at the Signal Iduna Park, where you just don't see these things happen, Schalke came back, third minute of extra time, of injury time, scored the equaliser, 4-4.
4-4. It's
and obviously
an homage.
They feel as if they've won the game.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just saying, also an homage probably to Arsenal and then their Newcastle.
Yeah, I saw a tweet that this hasn't happened in the top five leagues since Arsenal in 2001.
Really, since
Newcastle.
The Chelsea game?
Yeah, so it is not a dangerous lead as such.
Right, although it certainly proves so for Peter Bosz. What does he have to do to be fired?
I mean, this was supposed to be his make-or-break game. I suppose it was so chaotic and so strange and so out of the ordinary, and they had the AGM the next day, that they felt they couldn't quite pull the trigger, that they will give him at least one more shot.
Wow.
It is, in a way, as Hans-Joachim Watzke, the CEO, said at the AGM, their season in miniature because they started so well, scored a lot of goals, looked like by far like the best team in the Bundesliga. And then, since October, completely faded and fallen apart. And it's very difficult to explain. You can, of course, say the problem is Bosch's system. It's too attacking. It doesn't quite work. They leave a lot of gaps. It's naive. But I think it almost goes deeper than that. There are suggestions that there's something wrong with their fitness because they tend to concede a lot of goals after the 60th minute in every single game. There is a real concern, I think, that what happened to them before the Monaco game with the bomb going off next to their bus, which was a targeted assassination attempt, that some of that has still perhaps not kind of been worked through, and that frailty and that kind of, yeah, kind of lack of winning mentality, because we are perhaps preoccupied with other stuff, even if it's only a few percentage points, might have an impact. It's certainly one of the reasons why the club haven't been more critical of the team of late. They feel that there is maybe still an issue there.
A bigger picture.
And Bosch has been told by the club to sort it out or else. I think they like him. I think the players like him. He seems a very likable guy. He hasn't done anything to throw anyone under the bus, hasn't blamed anyone apart from himself, really. And I think they don't want to fire him. There's also, I think, a more pragmatic concern that there isn't really any ready-made replacement right now. Thomas Tuchel is obviously not going to come there for obvious reasons. There's been talk of Hitzfeld as some kind of fireman, but he's already said no, definitely not. Nagelsmann is not going to leave halfway through the season. So really, realistically, Bosch was already a manager who was quite far down the pecking order because he couldn't get the man who wanted. The man who wanted, Lucien Favre, is having a rotten time in Ligue 1. I think they lost again this weekend.
Well, they're in the bottom three now, yeah. So
he might be available, perhaps not really the right guy to come in right now to stem the tide. So it's a problematic setup, which of course hasn't been helped by this idea, not by the idea, by the fact that Schalke have overtaken them in the league.
Right.
Look as if they have the perfect manager in Domenico Tedesco, another German wonder kid, 31, 32 years old, who's managed to do something so far that no one's been able to do in recent years, which is actually to make Schalke a proper footballing side.
Wow. So they've now presumably closed the gap a little bit with Bayern by 1 point, because Bayern lost their first game under Jupp Heynckes after, what, nine?
Yeah, nine wins in a row. I mean, the 9 wins in a row papered over the cracks a little bit, because some of the games were hugely unconvincing. None more so than the Anderlecht game, where they're just real quite awful. And against Gladbach, they kind of just slept through the first half, didn't really wake up until very late, then did enough probably to get a draw, but injuries are beginning to bite. They have none of their regular sort of attacking players apart from Lewandowski fit. There's a problem in the left-back situation, and I think some of the issues that have been sort of underlying Bayern's demise, the lack of clear, coherent kind of playing strategy, is sort of coming back now to the fore. There was all this momentum, all this euphoria of getting rid of Ancelotti, that the players really responded to that. But you could see that bounce now has come to an end. And now Heynckes really needs to get down to actually working with his team and deciding what kind of football he wants to play with them.
Rafa, a couple of other questions. Is Aubameyang going to be moving on from Dortmund in January?
Don't think he'll move in January. Dortmund have been off the record, really quite willing to sell him now, not just this summer, but also the one before. But the right money never came in. So they made a decision, if we get some X, we will sell. And we've got these guys lined up. Jean-Kevin Augustin, by the way, from Leipzig, the under 21 French national, he was one of the guys that they had earmarked as his replacement. But when the deal never happened, but Aubameyang, of course, they couldn't afford anyone. So I think in January, Dortmund are extremely reluctant, like most Bundesliga sides, to sell anyone, knowing that they can't get anyone in unless some sort of really dramatic circumstances happen. So it's very unlikely. But just on that note, you know, you would have seen that Sven Mislintat, the Dortmund scout, have moved to Arsenal. And Watzke basically apologised for that at the AGM yesterday, saying, it's down to me. I should have done a lot more to keep him. It was my mistake that I let Thomas Tuchel, he didn't mention the name, but I let Thomas Tuchel treat him so badly for 1.5 years to get to the point where he felt he had to leave. That should have never happened.
Right. And also, I don't know if you saw, Jose Mourinho was saying some interesting things about Mkhitaryan, to wit that his performances have been decreasing step by step. Is he potentially on his way back to Dortmund?
I don't know if he's on his way back to Dortmund, because Dortmund were a little bit unhappy the way he left there. They felt he was a bit unprofessional the way he sort of forced through his move. They were quite keen to keep him. And it's one of the reasons why perhaps Tuchel struggled so much, because he was the third guy that was supposed to stay. They sold already Gundogan and Hummels, that was clear. Mkhitaryan, they thought they might keep. So I don't see necessarily a way back for him. I see, though, a huge market for him, but because the guy, when he plays well, is an absolute superstar. And I just wonder if it's just one of those creative players who Mourinho just always doesn't really get on with, because they're not behaving like soldiers and he wants soldiers on the pitch. It'd be interesting to see if there's going to be any reaction at all. I guess United are wealthy enough to sort of discard players like that. It doesn't matter to them. If a 30 or 40 million euro player doesn't work, they'll just sell him. So, and if, of course, if he does show a reaction, Mourinho can say, another brilliant piece of management here. I had to slam him before he woke up. I guess they're not really entirely bothered or not, whether it works out or not. It seems as almost as if he's written them off.
Mm. Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Chelsea, were it not for Mourinho, I know this is a little bit of a what if, could these days be lining up with Lukaku, Kevin De Bruyne,
Mohamed Salah.
But the extraordinary amount of talent that he has thrown on the scrap heap, or at least sold off for big dollar. Rafa, thank you so much for being with us.
My absolute pleasure.
We will catch up with you again soon. Auf Wiedersehen.
Tweet us at The Totally Football Show. Find us on Facebook and check us out at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Wednesday night, Ian McIntosh, Everton, West Ham. David Moyes goes back to Goodison. Would they have him back, do you think, if he was available right now?
I guess
that was an option.
Probably not. I don't. I think there's a feeling among the Everton supporters that I've heard from that they're not quite at the higher Pulis, Allardyce, Moyes kind of stage yet. They still think that there's enough potential there and enough season there that they can repair this under their own steam.
Well, they're in 16th place. Mm. They're only 2 points off the drop. And am I right in saying that performances seem to be getting worse, not better? 9 goals conceded in their last 2 matches.
I mean, I just, what do you even say about defending like that? At one point, I think Joe Royal actually came down and just put his arm around David Unsworth, which I think was the only decent thing that anyone connected with Everton did that day. It's now, I think, nearly 5 weeks since Ronald Koeman went, and they still seem no closer to finding a manager. There's been some reporting by Matt Hughes at the Times that suggests that no one really knows literally what they're doing. That you've got the owner wants one person, Steve Walsh wants someone else, presumably Bill Kenwright has his own ideas. There's also been suggestions that this was the reason for their recruitment confusion during the summer, where they didn't fill key positions, specifically replacing Romelu Lukaku. They just look a complete mess. And we were speaking earlier about Watford and how you have like everything just clicking together. The what's the leadership that Man City called for a few years ago?
Holistic.
Yes. Where Watford have the holistic leadership that Man City so famously called for a few years ago, with everything working towards one point. With Everton, you have nothing working towards anything.
Horrific, more like.
Oh, nice.
The idea of sacking a manager, people see that, the public image of that is just a snap decision. But the reality is that the days and weeks before the sacking, you kind of scout around, you have a word in the ear of an agent or an ear of a club to see if someone might be available. It looks as if Everton have completely forgotten that process and just woke up one morning and thought, we're going to sack Ronald Koeman this morning, and then thought, actually, we probably need another manager now.
I can only imagine, given that, you know, these are sentient people who can walk and talk and breathe and are not completely dunderheaded, that they must have just assumed that Marco Silva was going to jump across from Watford. But it is a little bit like taking one tyre off on your car without checking if you've got a spare.
Yeah, and the thing is...
It's far worse than that, actually. Far worse.
First team key players like Everton's don't perform badly for no reason. They are decent footballers. Some of them are having horrific seasons, and Ashley Williams is by far the worst. But they don't play badly for no reason. The example is set from the top down, and there is, as Ian says, there's no leadership there, so there is no example for those players to follow. And when that happens, and you have a caretaker manager who just seems to pick, sort of throw players' names on the table and then pick them in those positions as he is at the moment, then it's always going to look shambolic.
And this is just the mess that we can see. What's going on beneath the waterline? It's anyone's guess. Look at Wayne Rooney has been an unused sub for two league games on the bounce. I can imagine he's taken that pretty badly behind the scenes. Michael Keane, who started the season quite well, his confidence is just diminishing more and more of every day. And Jordan Pickford, who must have left Sunderland thinking, phew, I'll have a much easier campaign here with a decent team in front of me. Oy, what a mess.
Could I say something very much on a tangent about holistic leadership?
Oh, good, yeah.
Well, everyone laughed at Manchester City when they said that when they sacked Mancini and brought in Pellegrini. But I think a year later I went to a presentation by Manchester City's chief scout, because that's the kind of thing I do when I have some time off. And they basically showed these really interesting video clips about how, I think it was a game against Tottenham, and they scouted Tottenham, and they found that statistically Tottenham played a particularly high percentage of their passes through their two central midfielders.
Mm-hmm.
So they then got that, and then they devised a training strategy that basically involved Manchester City's two central midfielders always pushing up and others tucking in so they could shut down those two players. And then they went to a video from the game where they showed City pressing those two central midfielders and winning the ball and creating a chance. There was a problem at City because Roberto Mancini, who was there, wasn't someone who basically got on with the scouts and got on with the coaches, as you can probably imagine.
Right.
And they wanted someone who could bring those things all together. So people laughed at the word holistic, but I think it is how you need to run a football club.
I like synergy myself. There's synergy.
Synergy is quite nice.
Synergy.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you wanted an illustration, Daniel, I doubt you need one, but if you want an illustration of what a funny old game it is, Miguel Delaney pointing out that Everton are the only side so far this season to take points off Man City, and Adam Bate replying to him, the plans for Everton to solve their problems is to give Unsworth's job to the only man he's actually beaten so far, Marco Silva. Because that's the one win they've had.
Yeah.
It's curious, isn't it?
Well, on the City thing, Everton also held City at the Etihad last season. And of course, Ronald Koeman was, you know, best mates with Pep Guardiola, and they used to room together back in the Barcelona days. So you wonder whether there was something about his system that his coaching philosophy did kind of expose, or, you know, at least he knew what he was going to be up against.
Right. By the way, Saints,
yes,
who inflicted those goals on Everton, is it a coincidence that they suddenly score four goals in Charlie Austin's first start of the season?
I'd like to see a bigger sample size, purely because the Everton defending was so catastrophically bad that I don't know how much is due to Southampton being good and how much is due to Everton being bad. I suspect we'll find out when Southampton go and play Manchester City.
Yeah.
Southampton, who have only scored three goals on the road all season.
Ooh. For Ryan Burton in that game, who has a real chance of establishing himself as England's first choice left back, and he assisted two goals against Everton, which is the first time he's assisted a goal in the league since March, which, when you are firmly a left back and yet you want to be a wing back for your country, is a very good thing for him, I suspect.
All right. Southampton, anyway, a tough match at the Etihad. And as I said, you know, as we mentioned some time ago, at Goodison, it's going to be Everton against West Ham and David Moyes, who got a 1-1 draw in his first home game with the Hammers. 1-1 draw with Leicester. Lots of spirit, I believe, Ian. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one in that a draw at home with Leicester side in the bottom half is seen as a good thing. But it could have been so much worse, because after 7 minutes and a horrible goal to concede, you just thought, oh God, how bad is this going to get? And not only did they get back into the game was one thing, but there was actually noise at the London Stadium. And after all the concerns away at Watford in the previous game, where the fans were understandably furious at the board and furious at the state of things, the fans were actually behind the team, and it seemed to make a bit of difference. And just for the first time, he thought, maybe he can get out of this.
Speaking of atmosphere, just imagine how it's going to feel inside the O2 brackets, Indigo bit, close brackets, on Wednesday when myself, Ian McIntosh, mm-hmm. Rafa, who was in before, and also top funny man Kevin Bridges take the stage for our second ever Totally Football, Totally Live thing. And we're going to be giving away beer, shaving kits, books and computer games, says it. Basically, it's like Cracker Jack, but with football. Check out our Twitter and Facebook pages or thetotallyfootballshow.com for ticket details, but it's a forlorn hope, surely. Listeners to footballing podcasts will know that there's enough tough decisions to make these days without having to worry about which razor to use. So why don't you take the hassle out of your shaving routine by signing up with our pals Cornerstone. Never run out of blades, never need to shop again. Just let them know how often you shave and they'll take care of the rest. Get £10 off your first order and find out more about your perfect shave box at cornerstone.co.uk/totally. Wider world of football, Michael, part two.
Yep.
Spain, you watched Valencia-Barcelona because it was a massive top-of-the-table clash.
It was a massive top-of-the-table clash, and it was a very entertaining game, despite the fact that I was disappointed with Valencia in terms of how deep they sat and how defensive they were. I bigged them up on Thursday saying they always go for it. Well, they didn't here. They sat back and they took the old kind of park-the-bus strategy against Barcelona. But it was quite an interesting game and featured one of the most peculiar incidents you'll see all season.
Are you talking about the disallowed Leo Messi goal?
Yes. Well, not even disallowed, I guess, just not given. For anyone who didn't see it, Messi had a shot from about 25 yards out, straight at Neto, the goalkeeper, who managed to not catch the ball in such a spectacular fashion that he dropped it through his legs and over the goal line, and then had to do a kind of Roy Carroll-esque scramble to get the ball from over the goal line. And it was just so clearly in from the first angle. And I do have some sympathy for the linesman. He wasn't in line because there's no reason he should be in line. He's sprinting to get back. His pitch level, which I think people often forget, is not the best level to be at in terms of these things. But it was clearly over the line. And of course, La Liga is the only major league where they don't use goal line technology.
And
so the Barcelona players were off essentially supporting by the corner flag, while the Valencia players got on with a counter-attack and nearly scored through Simone Zaza, which would have been incredible.
Right.
I mean, for more than one reason.
The Liga having brought it in because it would cost too much money, I believe.
Yeah, supposedly. Yeah.
Remarkable. But anyway, the draw, as it stood, a 1-1 draw, which means that Valencia, well, there's no change.
Yeah, it was an interesting game. I mean, it opened out after half-time. I mean, on a tactical level, I thought it was interesting. Both teams pretty much played 4-4-2, which you just don't associate with Spanish football. Valencia went ahead through Rodrigo when Jose Gea went down the left, overlapped. Rakitic wasn't really tracking him and crossed for Rodrigo. And then it was Barcelona's left-back, Jordi Alba, who got them back in the game. Of course, that is old team, with a wonderful pass from Messi. Messi is almost playing a old-school Argentine number 10 role now, orchestrating things, a little bit of a slower pace. But I thought it was concerning for Barcelona how little they had going in behind. I mean, they, you know, in the glory days, if you like, they always had the possession football with so many midfielders, but they always had players running in behind, Pedro in particular, David Villa. Suarez was playing that role, but got caught offside, I think, about seven times. Just couldn't time his runs. And you think, you know, he doesn't look very physically sharp at the moment. You think maybe he's getting caught offside because he's just not fast enough. So it's up to Jordi Alba and, to a certain extent, Semedo on the other flank, who's proved a very good signing to provide that movement in behind.
Barcelona, who are coming off a 0-0 draw away in Turin. Daniel, did you want to throw something
in? Yeah, I was just going to say, for all the criticism of Real Madrid's front line this season, Suarez has arguably been the worst of the lot between the two clubs. He looks so, so far off, not just his Liverpool best, but even his first season at Barcelona best. And at the age he is, that might be that for Luis Suarez in peak form.
Wow, do you think?
He just looks... The offsides is a case in point, because it almost looks as if he's kind of 2 seconds later in the game and he's not reacting until things have happened, and defenders are just thinking quicker than him at the moment, which is really worrying.
Leo Messi, in the meantime, settling that long-running contract extension thing with a pretty massive, what is it, about 90 million euros a year, I think. 45 net, that was the figure I saw quoted. So I don't know. I mean, it depends how much tax they're going to be paying. But, OK, so net. No, which is a very real question, particularly with, you know, the Spanish giants. But, yeah, so 45 million a year net, euros.
Well, that's obviously good news for Barcelona because, you know, he's their only star at the moment. I think, actually, the Spanish league really is probably at its lowest quality for quite a long time, maybe a decade or more. Mm. I mean, Barcelona are top. It's not a great Barcelona team. You take every Barcelona season for the last 10 years, it's probably the seventh or eighth best team, and they're streaking away at the top of the league. Valencia, this wasn't their best game. They're a good team, and Marcelino's done a really good job. But again, it's not a classic team. You know, this is a league that's really dominated European football for the last decade, but there's not a great amount of quality in that. At the top of the league that season.
You'd have got good odds on a year ago on Simone Zaza being involved in a title race in any top tier league.
Fair but point.
If the superiority of Spain wanes, who takes over? I mean, does the Premier League step up? Is that like the recognised best league? Is it Germany's turn?
I think Serie A would have had big ideas of itself in the summer. I know Milan have been well below par, but the talk in the summer was of a genuine title race, and I think we've got one with Napoli and with potentially with Inter as well. So maybe Serie A, sort of a reboom. But yeah, the Premier League would consider itself above that.
Other contenders include, of course, the SPL. Or, Daniel, Belarus.
Yeah, where Dynamo Mix thought they'd won the league. Barty then went 3-1 down, needing a draw to seal the title. 3-1 down with, I think, 12 minutes to go. And scored in the last minute to win the title.
Wow. Tyler have been commentating.
You think that's exciting?
Oh, go on.
What about the Georgian title?
Oh.
Did you see this?
No.
We're all over it. Dynamo Tbilisi battling out with Torpedo Kutaisi. I'm sure you've seen a few times this season. Torpedo Kutaisi were leading 1-0. Dynamo Tbilisi had a 96th-minute penalty. If they scored it, Tbilisi won the title. If they missed it, Kutaisi won the title.
Right.
They missed it.
No way!
Yeah.
That is a dramatic finale.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, but you were talking about Serie A in all seriousness, and we're going to have a big news roundup with James Horncastle on Thursday, but of course, the headline news today, this Monday, is the fact that Milan, after their 0-0 draw with Torino at the weekend, have let Vincenzo Montella go and replaced him with one of the, you know, vecchie glorie, Gennaro Gattuso. Gennaro Gattuso, who's had an interesting time of it. He'll be feisty.
Well, his record with Pisa last season was extraordinary.
Well, there were difficult circumstances, no?
Difficult circumstances. I mean, just in a statistical sense, they had the second best defence in the league and finished bottom.
Yeah.
Which shows you how few goals they scored. But I think Montella is actually a really interesting coach. It's been a difficult situation for him at Milan with so many players coming in.
Yeah.
But I think he's a perfect manager for Everton's squad.
Montella.
You look at what he did at Fiorentina. He brought in so many creative passing midfielders. Valero, Aquilani, Matty Fernandez, David Pizarro. And you thought, well, how on earth is he going to accommodate all of them? And he did it with a 3-5-2 or with a diamond midfield. And that's all the kind of players that Everton have got. What kind of manager wants a load of ball-playing midfielders? Vincenzo Montella does. So I say give him 6 months to learn English.
Poor bloke. He's just been sacked and now you're linking him with Everton.
I think Everton's a really good... Not the current situation is difficult, but I think Everton's a decent club to take over.
It's a very interesting shout, Michael.
A good squad.
Do you know, he's not the only manager suddenly available in Serie A. There's been three gone in the last week. But this weekend, Napoli won at the top, Inter also won, and Juventus, who are now third, one. So they have kind of shifted away a little bit from the two Roman sides, both of whom drew. Roma were a goal up thanks to Steven Alshaarawy. And then there was a very regrettable incident. Did you see Daniele De Rossi? Basically, he slapped Gianluca Lapadula. It basically just slapped him in the face and then went down clutching his own face. But he forgot that they have VAR there and he was done and there was a penalty and Genoa equalised. But Steve Malanga says, for how many matches would you suspend De Rossi? A lot. I mean, I was really surprised at him. You know, a player of that stature, Roma captain.
That poor.
He didn't just go in, you know, hard or something. He actually slapped him in the face. It was a very sneaky move. More on all of that Serie A business on Thursday. Plenty more to discuss. We'll get back to the Premier League after this. You stayed with us this long, listeners, and you won't be disappointed, because here's the bit where we talk about Palace, the fact that they got a win, the fact that they could move off the bottom of the table midweek, and the fact that they're taking on their eternal rivals, Brighton. Ian.
Hey, I got all kinds of pelters last week because I praised Crystal Palace. And I said, I don't think they're that bad, and I think they're very close to getting out of it.
Who criticised you for that?
Oh, just people.
Right.
You know, it's okay.
People say all sorts of things. I noticed you were getting dog's abuse, is that the phrase?
Yeah, yeah.
For suggesting that Man City's unbeaten run was actually 11 games as opposed to 18.
Yeah, it's a nonsense, and I went onto their website and checked, and even they've got it on their fixtures results page as a draw.
Who have?
Man City. Despite the fact they put out a news report saying it's a win, their fixtures results page is a draw.
Let's agree to disagree, I think is the line you want.
they're disagreeing with themselves, James.
All right, then.
Palace haven't played badly for a number of games now. They got this last-minute winner against Stoke. That's a good win. They got that last-minute equaliser against West Ham. They actually played very well against Spurs, only to lose. And they beat Chelsea, going back, I think that's six games going back. Mm-hmm. There is a base of a team there. There's something that they can build on. There's lots of pace up front.
Benteke's back.
Not necessarily sure if that's a positive, but the way they have those wingers as twin centre-forwards peeling off wide and causing all kinds of problems, and they got a win that they deserved here. And no, they're not very far off.
But if Shawcross hadn't cleared off the line for the other team...
Yeah, if my Uncle Arthur didn't have balls, it'd be...
But that was extraordinary.
It was an extraordinary miss. But I think Palace deserved a bit of good fortune after all this. But look at their games coming up. Brighton will be very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Very few people could drill a defence like Chris Hughton, and they've been outstanding this season. They've also got West Brom, and then they've got Bournemouth at home. These are winnable games. Mm. By Christmas, they could be out of this.
But that Brighton fixture will be anything but easy, because, of course, it's one of the biggest, most storied rivalries in English football.
Yeah, they loathe
on account
each other.
Because, Ian?
Well, there's a number of different reasons. One of it is a rivalry between Alan Mullery and Terry Venables and how their two teams were clashing for promotion. Others put it down to the plagiarisation. There's a really good article in the Times on this, by the way. That's why I'm sounding rarely informed. Plagiarisation of the chant of eagles being converted to seagulls. And also the...
How does that chant go?
Eagles.
That's the one.
I had no idea that had originated at one of those two teams.
Well, there's an argument over who started that one. And also the terrible tackle that ended the career of Jerry Ryan by Crystal Palace's Henry Hughton. Hughton, you say? Yes, brother of Chris.
No way.
I know. I told you it was worth waiting for.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was the poo incident also?
The poo incident is also involved. Yeah. I was going to leave that one out. But
what?
Did you hear this?
What kind of podcast do you think this is?
There was quotes from Gus Poyet last week where he said, sensationally, said that was a massive problem. I got done in by that poo because it was a lucky poo. It was a lucky poo that inspired our opposition, which is a reasonable excuse for.
Just for anyone who's struggling with this, Palace turned up at Brighton to find that their changing room was basically covered in poo.
I thought it was just one in the middle of the room.
Right in the middle.
I think it was just one.
Sort of modern art exhibit.
Like a stack.
And and metaphorically, they pinned that to the dressing room wall.
Very metaphorically.
Yeah.
Martin Luther nailing his feces to the wall.
Right. Well, we'll see if Rwengi is on the cards on Tuesday. Swansea, where are they going? They're going to Chelsea, aren't they? And they just had a point. They got a point at home to Bournemouth. I know there's something you want to tell us about this, Daniel.
They're going to Chelsea and they're going down pretty quickly. In their last three games, they've played Bournemouth, Burnley and Brighton, and they've had four shots on target in total. They have effectively piled everything onto the young shoulders of Tammy Abraham, and it's not working.
Can't even play this midweek.
No, and he's done it. They've basically done a budget version of Everton in that they... Everton sold a striker and replaced him with lots of midfielders, and they sold an attacking midfielder and replaced him with lots of central midfielders.
And bizarrely, the same players at the centre of the transfer there.
Absolutely.
One loses Sigurdsson and doesn't replace him. The other tries to replace the centre forward with Sigurdsson.
The worry for Swansea is that they actually haven't defended that badly. I think there's 10 Premier League teams that have kept fewer clean sheets than Swansea, and they kept another one at the weekend. But their attack is so poor and so lacking any imagination. And we all saw this coming. When they sold Gylfie Sigurdsson, we all knew how important he was to their attack, and so must they. So this is no surprise. Clement will eventually, I suspect, pay the price and
I think four of the bottom five have sat their managers this season, and they're the exception.
Okay. Because I did read something about Tony Pulis being linked, which I know seems an anathema to the historic way of philosophy of football down there.
But push as comes to shove, and they need some more pragmatism. And he's Welsh. They're a Welsh club. It kind of fits. But the issue is not them conceding goals. Generally, when Tony Pulis comes in as a firefighter, it's because a team is shipping too many goals.
Right.
They're actually reasonably defensively sound. It's the fact that they're doing nothing going forward. They are not a club with big transfer budgets either, but I suspect they will have to release some funds in January to bring in at least two attacking players, or I fear that they're going to finish bottom.
Now, ain't nothing going on but the rent department. Making a twice-weekly popular football podcast for free isn't always easy, and as you've probably gathered, we've found someone to help us with that, Paddy Power. Now, going forward, we're going to play a little game with them every week with some odds, hopefully raise a little bit of money for good causes. And today, we're joined by Mr. Power himself with some of the key odds from this set of midweek fixtures. Hello.
Please call me Paddy. You can't let me sound old. I'm actually old enough to remember you from the heydays of Italian football, James. There you go. But yeah, Paddy, please.
Right. Okay. You've picked out some. We've got a full round of midweek fixtures. Four games in particular that we're interested in. Can you give us the odds? First of all, for Watford beating Man United.
I can indeed. Yeah, they're a decent price. They're 9-2, which is 4.5-1. And I guess you're taking your life in your hands a bit. United can't really buy a goal, an own goal they needed at the weekend. But Watford got beaten by Everton a few weeks ago. So yeah, 9-2. You couldn't be banking on United anyway, but I'm not sure Watford are going to get the job done, to be honest. But who am I to say?
We're undecided. We had a fair old chat about that. We're a little bit more clear on Swansea's chances away to Chelsea, but what are your odds on that?
This is a funny one. Swansea are, well, they're 16-1 to win, but to get a draw, they're 6-1. For a draw in that game. Chelsea are very, very short odds. They're 1-6. In fact, they're the shortest odds. They're as short as Arsenal and City are. The three of them are the shortest odds of the midweek fixtures, but 6-1 on. So 1-6 Chelsea to win. So if you want Swansea to win at 16s, but the draw is maybe more of a chance of a draw maybe at 6-1. But I wouldn't be picking this one anyway. I think Chelsea would probably be genuine bankers.
Absolutely. Narrative klaxon as David Moyes returns to Goodison. Will he get his first win there? What do the numbers say?
The numbers say that he probably won't. Everton are favourites at 5-4. West Ham are 23-10, so that's a 2.5-1. And the draw is 23-10 there as well. So even if you're an Everton fan, you probably like David Moyes. You probably couldn't fancy yourselves to beat David Moyes coming back home to roost. I think this is actually a reasonable chance this happening. Everton are just so all over the shop at the moment that, if West Ham are going to get a win, it's going to be at Goodison. Yeah, I think that's a decent bet.
All right. An interesting one to finish, Paddy. The Eagles-Seagulls game, which we were just discussing how heated that's going to be. What are the odds of a red card?
Yeah, red card is actually, it's a good shout in this one. I mean, that's going to be a real tight game and both teams really desperate not to drop points. But 5-2 for a red card in that game. And that could be, it could be a decent shout, to be honest.
All right. Paddy, thank you so much for joining us. And best of luck with that.
Thanks for that.
Hello, I'm Ian McIntosh, and you may have noticed the Muddy Knees Media is expanding. We are going to be doing lots of new shows. We're going to need lots of new people, but the first person we need is a community manager. Now, you may already have seen our advert on Twitter, and if you haven't, well, you're probably not the person for us. What we need is someone to get across all of our social media outlets, the Twitter and the Facebook, and really to find out if there's any more we can use to do all the things that, frankly, we're too old to do. Please send CVs to hello@muddyneesmedia.com with Community Manager in block capitals in the subject header. A closing date for applications is December the 1st. It's only about a week. You haven't got long. And the work, well, that will start in January.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's 2D Football show. Apart from the fact that we need to just flag up the life in the Football League, the Championship, etc., which you're going to be doing in the Totally Football League show. A couple of questions I wanted to ask you about, though. I know that Wolves have won their fifth in a row, 5-1 at home to Bolton, sending them to the bottom of the Championship because Chris Coleman at Sunderland,
yes,
gone straight in and get a win. Gets a win.
And we will be talking about that a lot tomorrow. Chris Coleman's first win, smiles on faces. He's instructed the players to go out and enjoy the moment because they've been so unhappy for so long. It is only a win over Burton, who are the smallest team in the division by absolutely miles. But who knows, it might be a turning point. We'll have Ian Barraclough in the studio, and me and Matt, and we'll be talking about that and Bristol Rovers as well.
Super. Well, I look forward to that on Tuesday. Excellent. Well, that's it then for today's Totally Football Show. Many thanks to you, Daniel Storey.
Thank you for having
me. Always great to see you. And you, Michael Cox.
Thank you.
Okay, Football League Show will be up on Tuesday. We'll be back on Thursday. Have yourselves a splendid time until then.